Yeah, so I think without further ado, I'd like to introduce our first speaker, who is Lucia Viegas. She started her actual career at Alexander Forbes in 2009 with a role in the retirement fund valuations team. Following 6 years at Alexander Forbes, Lucia moved into academia with the teaching and research supervision role at WITS. In April 2023, she was recruited to Bond University on the east coast of Australia, which is where she currently resides. There, she continues in an academic role as an assistant professor and is enrolled in a PhD with a research focus on post-retirement quality of life in the era of longevity. Lucia joined Colourfield in January 2021 on a part-time basis as a support to the investment team and continues in this role from Australia. Lucia served on the retirement matters and the education committees at ASA for 7 years until she relocated overseas. She's currently a fellow of ASA and the IAA. She has two children and a supportive husband who are an unwavering source of encouragement in her career aspirations. I think a lot of us has heard previous talks from Lucia, so we really look forward to this. It's titled Analyzing Post-Retirement Products in the Context of Utility Theory. So I definitely think a lot of that all of us can learn from that. Thanks, Lucia.
Thank you for the intro and thank you to SM RMC for having me to present today. It's about 4:30 in the afternoon here, so I'm probably not as cold as I would be on a crispy Joburg winter's morning, but I certainly am very happy to be ending my day in some good company. So when Stephen first sent out requests for speakers, he specifically mentioned that he wanted something technical. So I went and drew on the most technical student research that I've supervised, and that's what I'll be presenting to you today. So today I will be discussing retirement products in the context of utility theory. So I'll first take you through an introduction, including the basis for the presentation and how this research came into existence. We can then have a look at some prior research that has been done in the area, which is foundational to this presentation. Thereafter, I'll take you through the methodology used in this research process and the retirement products that we covered in the analysis. Finally, we'll look at the findings and in conclusion, look at how we can further this research in a more practical way for the future. Okay, so a little bit of context. The basis of the presentation is a paper that is titled Risk versus Reward, Analyzing Post-Retirement Products in the Context of Utility Theory. Some background on how this paper came into existence. As part of the actuarial honours degree at WITS University, the students are required to pair up and produce a research dissertation. The topics of research are put forward by the supervisors, and the students then go through a process where they choose their project and their supervisor or those that they think will be most suited or best suited to them. I was very lucky in 2022 to be a supervisor to two really brilliant students, Ms. Tino Tenda Mudzengwa and Ms. Wisanu Ndlovu. And this is their paper, this is their research that I supervised and gave instruction on, but this is their work and I really want to give them credit for that. This paper did receive a distinction at the time, but it's not hasn't been published. And unfortunately, I was not able to get in touch with them after having lost contact once I moved away. Okay, so interest. Menahem Yari is most famous for his seminal work, Uncertain Lifetime, Life Insurance, and the Theory of the Consumer, in which he stated, one need hardly be reminded that a consumer who makes plans for the future must, in one way or another, take account of the fact that he does not know how long he will live. And thus originated the infamous annuity puzzle, specifically the question of, why do people not purchase guaranteed income annuities to the extent predicted by economic theory? This paper tries to add to or perhaps place another piece in South Africa's annuity puzzle by applying utility theory to evaluate the design of various post-retirement annuity, if I can put in air quotes, annuity products. So this is done in the context of some human behavioral effects and considers various options, some in the mainstream and others not. So the research had two major questions. Firstly, an investigation into the utility tools available to determine which of those would be most effective for the research. And secondly, to review and compare the post-retirement products under the microscope of the utility approach chosen. Now, every researcher understands that we stand on the shoulders of giants. And this research did rely on prior work done on utility in the post-retirement product space. However, the authors did add a couple of novel elements in their research. Firstly, as far as we could tell, on the basis of quite recent literature, this was the first time that utility theory had been applied to a drawdown product, such as a living annuity, for comparison to other risk-sharing based products. The authors also tailored the research to South Africa by incorporating South African mortality and wealth data into their model. And in addition to this, the model projections and adaptations, the authors also applied assumptions relating to return, age and retirement, and government transfers that are unique to South Africa. I also want to make mention that during this process, the ladies did come up with a novel product that they wanted to test. However, because the paper became so long and due to time constraints involved in an honors project, we simply weren't able to include that in the paper. Having a look now at some prior research. Now, there is a very large body of research that attempts to explain the annuity puzzle. Major themes that come from the literature are rational factors, behavioral factors, and framing. I have also added my own personal piece of information, or my own personal view of defined contribution arrangements to the presentation that was not covered in the literature review and also not covered in this paper, but I kind of thought of it while I was going through and preparing for this presentation. First of all, with respect to the rational factors, so these are the ones that we can almost forgive consumers for, or at the very least empathize with consumers. First of all is the perceived notion that annuities are expensive or perhaps unfairly priced. Annuity providers do have onerous solvency requirements, and those are perceived to add a layer of expense to guaranteed annuity products. Administrative costs and elements of profit pressure that are borne by the provider are often passed on to policyholders in the form of more expensive products. And of course, adverse selection in life annuities cannot be ignored. Aging populations definitely seem to be contagious, and they drive up the cost of annuities. Loss of access and flexibility to one's money. So retirees tend to struggle with the idea of losing access to their very large capital sum or retirement savings, even though in truth they don't actually lose access to this money. However, it can be said, or it seems to be, that having your money in the bank is better than waiting for your money to get into the bank at the end of every month. Bequest motives always come up and are often part of the discussion around the annuity puzzle. There is a bit of mixed messaging around this, but it certainly plays a role in investor behavior. Insurer default comes in here a little bit as well. Investors sometimes are afraid that one day the insurer might default on their payments. I mean, that is interesting in the context of living annuities, where that is really the greatest risk of running out of money. Inequity of housing wealth. The majority of an individual's wealth is most often invested in their home at retirement. If they are unable to liquidate this large asset, or they are unable to get the price that they want, there simply might not be enough money available to purchase an effective post-retirement product. And finally, means-tested benefits, means-tested state benefits. So the question is, why would somebody annuitize their savings when they can rely on the state pension? Now, this is not really the case in South Africa, since the state pension or the state old age grant is means tested and it is really minimal. But on the lower earning end, if you have access to a lump sum benefit, why not take the lump sum and then rely on the state as a safety net? Some other behavioral factors. Now, these are the factors that we get a little bit more frustrated about with consumers and probably have a little bit less understanding of, but they exist nonetheless. So first of all, mortality salience. Mortality salience refers to an enhanced accessibility of thoughts related to death. And that comes with purchasing an annuity. So individuals are kind of forced to think of their own mortality when they purchase annuities. And so instead of purchasing an annuity, they kind of just ignore everything altogether and keep the lump sum. So people tend to have subjective mortality beliefs. What that means is that research has shown that people are pessimistic about overall mortality. So they generally think that their friends die early, but they're optimistic about their own mortality. So they expect to outlive their peers. This makes longevity insurance seem overpriced because the insurer is pricing on the assumption that everybody lives a long time. and longevity risk sharing seems underpriced. So if policyholders believe they are going to outlive their peers, then, and they have the last man standing syndrome, or I call it the last man standing syndrome, that has varying effects depending on what the product type is. In terms of framing, positive or negative framing both greatly impact annuity purchase decisions. Positive framing is when you highlight the positive outcomes because of following a course of action. Negative framing is when you highlight what could go wrong if you don't follow a course of action. So, for example, when purchasing an annuity, positive framing would be highlighting the longevity protection if you buy the annuity versus highlighting running out of money, which would be negative framing if you don't buy the annuity. Even when information is factually correct, not exaggerated, and objective, framing can still occur unintentionally. For example, consumption versus investment framing. So consumption framing emphasizes the end result. In other words, what an individual can spend and consume over time. Whereas investment framing emphasizes the ongoing results of risk and return features of an asset. So the consumption frame results in a higher rate of annuitization than an investment frame. And that will speak to a little bit about the defined contribution arrangement view that I have. So my view on defined contribution arrangements, or what has evolved over time for me, is that the prevalence of defined contribution arrangements works against the post-retirement goals that we as actuaries have for individuals. In defined contribution arrangements, people arguably don't really think of their retirement savings as a future income because it is often presented as a lump sum. So essentially, we've lost that notion of a liability attached to the retirement savings. A defined contribution arrangement is therefore often seen as an investment rather than a savings product. And as a result, there really isn't a natural transition into an annuity because that income is not explicitly defined for retirees anymore. Nowadays, retirement savings is seen as an investment, and it continues that way for people who purchase living annuities and continue to work with them as an investment. In terms of prior research, the products that were considered in the papers that we reviewed were pontine, pooled annuity funds, and a life annuity. A pure pontine structure is unlikely to be suitable as a retirement product without a bit of refinement. And if you go through the papers, you'll see that a lot of work has been done on trying to make a tontine suitable as a retirement product. Essentially, in a tontine, each member makes a capital contribution, and the first time anyone receives any type of income is upon the death of the first member in the pool. The capital investment of the deceased person is shared equally or proportionately, depending on the structure, between surviving members. With a large enough pool and regular enough deaths, the tontine does mimic an annuity-type income. With each descendant, or decedent, let me say, the capital investment of that person plus all of the investment returns then gets shared amongst an ever-reducing group of survivors if the pool is closed. In a tontine, the investment risk does fully lie with the members. The longest survivors benefit from receiving the capital and the returns of their expiring peers. The tontine is the most basic and unrefined structure from a retirement income perspective. However, the literature does show that with some minor adjustments, tontines are adaptable enough to feature at some point in the product space. A pooled annuity fund also consists of a group of members, each of whom make a capital contribution at entry. However, in this case, the capital is contributed specifically to purchase an income, like you would with an insurance company. The income is then priced on the expectation of the future mortality experience of the average member in the group, as well as some kind of investment return assumption. Getting either of those assumptions wrong has major consequences for the members who shoulder all of the longevity and investment risk in these pools. The familiar term for this is an in-fund annuity in South Africa, and some certainly do exist in practice. In a world where investment risk in these types of structures can almost be fully eliminated, with careful calculation and regular risk management, in-fund solutions could potentially be very practical compromises between tontines and guaranteed life annuities. Finally, a life annuity, I'm sure that this audience needs no explanation what a life annuity is. What I will say is that the life annuities at the most basic level that are tested through the utility process are obviously the insurer bears all the risk in the product. And in most cases, the utility testing is done on a level guaranteed annuity. So results from some earlier studies where utility has been tested have been quite conflicting. Some results have suggested that in certain circumstances, the pooled annuity funds in which longevity risk is retained are preferable to a guaranteed life annuity, largely because of the expenses and capital costs that are associated with the life annuities. Other studies have suggested that annuities offer higher utility than tontines, but also in other circumstances, tontines end up offering higher utility than annuities. So depending on the adaptations, different outcomes are possible. Okay, looking at the methodology of this paper in particular, first of all, the authors simulated homogeneous lifetime data. So homogeneous groups of lives were simulated. They were assumed to be identical and independent of one another. The base case of a life applied in the model was a 60-year-old male with an initial wealth level of 1.1 million rand. The age of 60 was chosen to match the age at which an individual becomes eligible for the state old age grant in South Africa. The initial capital of 1.1 million was calculated as the average wealth level of a person aged 60 and above in the highest wealth quintile in South Africa based on the 2017 South African Wealth Index. For the mortality, a shocked Gomperz model was used, which allows for the application of a longevity shock. This is consistent with the modeling requirements of Solvency II and SAM regulation in Europe and South Africa, respectively, and that is particularly why this type of model was chosen. The mortality rates were consistent with full life tables for South Africa from vital registration data 2006 to 2008, and the model could be adjusted as well for subjective mortality beliefs. The model was also then parameterized on the basis of the South African mortality data using root mean squared error calculations and testing and back testing against that data. The utility function, when modeling the utility, the function chosen was a constant relative risk aversion utility function. This was chosen because it allowed for flexibility in age, income, wealth, and various payoff structures, which was quite important to compare different products. Adaptations could also be made for subjective mortality beliefs, government transfers, and bequest motives. Okay, it's always important to include the model, but I know this is often where I lose my students, so please bear with me. The expected discounted lifetime utility was calculated in each case for each product by using the equation that you can see on the screen. Now, to determine this utility, the equation is that the discounted lifetime utility at time t is the total discounted lifetime utility achieved in the prior year plus the utility derived from the payout from the next payment of the product, if the life is still then alive to receive it. And this utility function is then discounted back from time t to time zero in order to get a result. The rate of interest used in the calculations was set equal to the 30-year bond yield at the time that this paper was written, and that was approximately 11.5% at the time. It's also important to note that the rate of interest used was deterministic and the same for all the retirement products that we tested. Okay, the previous equation that you saw, the one that's on your screen now, is for the base case. That is the situation where no adaptations are made for things like bequest motives, subjective mortality beliefs, or government transfers. Now, this equation allows for government transfers to be included in the utility function as part of the consumption level. It also allows for a bequest motive by allowing for a non-zero term to arise on the death of an individual between time t and time t minus one. And on death, it allows for an adjustment factor which includes utility for bequests. So that it's a bit of a complex adaptation, but it allows for a time-dependent value of the bequest and a variable that represents the strength of the bequest motive. The discount factor, there is an additional discount factor that is then just accelerated by half a year, and that just assumes that mortality or deaths occur halfway through the year on average. Okay, moving on to the retirement products that were tested. So in this paper, the different products that were tested were based, the payoffs for the surviving members of the products are as follows. So for a life annuity, always level payments, always the same nominal value, obviously decreasing in real terms, but guaranteed, which means that the payout F times T is always equal to a value of C. For a tontine, the payout at time T is dependent on the number of lives that die between time T and between time T minus 1 and time T. That number of lives multiplied by their capital values at that time, inclusive of all of the investment return to that point, is then divided by the survivors in the pool at time T. So the longer you survive in a tontine, the greater the level of income you receive. For a pooled annuity fund, a pooled annuity fund is the payout at time T that is explicitly dependent on the payout the year before. Here, there has to be an adaptation to reflect how actual mortality has compared to expected mortality. Where actual mortality has been worse than expected, this payoff increases because there are greater level of mortality credits, whereas if actual mortality has been less than expected, then there's going to be a reduction in payment because more lives are there than what they thought would be. In a living annuity, the payout at time T is simply equal to D, which is the drawdown, the constant drawdown percentage that was assumed in the modeling, multiplied by the capital value at time T. The living annuity in this model was the only one that did allow for a bequest, and on death between time T minus 1 and time T, the capital value remaining in the living annuity was allowed to be paid to the estate. I think at this point, it is important to note that with the living annuity, the drawdown percentage for all of the base case testing was set at the rate of interest that was earned, which meant that there was always a level nominal payment similar to an annuity structure, and obviously the capital was always retained at that point. Okay, looking at some of the results. So the chart on the screen shows the base case assumptions for each of the products that were tested. In other words, all of the adaptations related to subjective mortality beliefs, bequest motives, and government transfers have been ignored. The level of utility derived from each product does diverge quite quickly after the assumed retirement age of 60. At ages in excess of 80 years, there is a stabilization that occurs in each of the curves, and this was caused because of the high mortality rates and the long discount terms after the age of 60, which causes the marginal sum of terms just to tend towards zero. Under objective mortality beliefs, which is what this graph shows, the tontine does come out tops, but only marginally so against the guaranteed life annuity. This result does concur with previous research in other countries and is most likely just because the expenses and capital costs incurred by an insurer tend to be higher than those experienced in a tontine structure. This also means, obviously, that the level of payment in a tontine is likely to be higher. And of course, the longer you live, the greater value you get. Interestingly, the living annuity first offers a lower utility than the pooled annuity fund or the in-fund annuity, but this pattern then does reverse at approximately age 80. Now, as mentioned before, the mortality rates after age 80 do become much higher. And so survivors beyond this age in a pooled annuity fund are really experiencing above average longevity. And as a result, they are the ones who are potentially met with reductions in their pay. And that's what causes the reduction in utility of this type of product. Importantly, in the base case assumption, the drawdown rate in the, the drawdown rate in the living annuity is equal to the return earned each year, which means that the payment remains constant. I will later look at a graph that shows what happens when we vary those drawdown rates. Okay, so that was the base case without any adaptations. This is alongside one another, including all adaptations, and you can see that the graph ends at minus 17 instead of minus 18, which was the original base case. So having looked now at all adaptations, once orders and bequest motives, what happens is the absolute discounted lifetime utility increases for all of the products. And bequest motives, what happens is the absolute discounted lifetime utility increases for all of the products. The shape of each curve does remain the same, and the ranking of the products remains the same. However, what is interesting is that there is a widening of the gap between the annuity and the tontine. So the tontine now offers even better value or better utility relative to the annuity than it did before. This is most likely due to that impact of subjective mortality belief, where the consumers believe that they will be the last man standing. In this case, they can get a lot of money from their friends if their friends die before them. And as a result, it offers better utility. The gap between the pooled annuity fund and the living annuity has actually reduced under all adaptations. This is most likely due to the impact of having government transfers as a safety net if payments reduce far enough in the pooled annuity to the extent that they need to rely on that means-tested benefit. So this is interesting because payments are not actually expected to reduce in nominal terms in the living annuity. However, that gap has still reduced, which shows the strength of having the safety net. So the strength of utility of having the safety net, which seems to even outweigh the utility of having a bequest. Okay, the authors did also test adaptations one at a time. So this chart that you see now looks at an adaptation only for government transfers, nothing else. When only government transfers are allowed for, the annuity, tontine, and living annuity levels are not significantly different from the base case. And that would make sense because under the assumptions, it is unlikely that the policyholder or the member will ever actually meet the requirements of the means test. However, the absolute utility of the pooled annuity increases substantially and always outperforms the living annuity now, once the safety net is introduced, even though the safety net is really very low. Utility therefore increases significantly at the prospect of having some kind of safety net, even when that safety net is very low and there is a low likelihood of getting to that, to having to actually have that safety net. In the second graph, this just looks at what happens if the model is adapted for subjective mortality beliefs alone. So just a reminder, subjective mortality beliefs are the belief that your peers die early and you outlive all of them. So everybody else has worse mortality than you do. Okay, so the utility derived from the guaranteed life annuity and the tontine both increase relative to the base case. That's obviously due to the impact of longevity. So with the annuity, you've got longevity protection, and with the tontine, you're getting more income because you're outliving everybody else. The living annuity doesn't change significantly, but that also makes sense because of the assumptions that have been used in that calculation. The utility, however, from the pooled annuity fund decreases dramatically. That is because of the last man standing effect. This is how the tontine and the pooled annuity fund are dramatically different from one another. In the pooled annuity fund, you are on the wrong side of average if you live longer than everybody else. Okay, having a look at varying the drawdown rates in a living annuity, which is obviously extremely important in South Africa, they were varied above and below the investment return assumption. The lowest level of drawdown being 2.5% was tested. The utility of that was obviously extremely low for obvious reasons and does not even come into the chart here. Interestingly, there is a higher utility derived from drawing slightly more than the investment return earned on the capital. So the investment return that was earned was approximately 11.5%. Utility was better when you were drawing down at around 12.8% rather than just drawing down what you are earning and holding your capital. This is a little bit contrary to what we would expect when we think about bequest motives, especially when we allow for subjective mortality beliefs. This suggests that people prefer to actually increase their own consumption levels, even if it is at the expense of a possible bequest later on. Drawing down at the highest possible level of 17.5% is wonderful and has the highest utility level unless you survive past the age of about 75. Then it reduces significantly, and once again, the reason for that is obvious. If you draw far more than you earn, you're going to end up running out of money and relying on that means-tested, very low state benefit. In conclusion, So the key takeaways for me, at least, was that with some testing between the different products, it came to be that neither a life annuity nor a living annuity came out best in any of the cases. In theory, and with some allowance for consumer behavior, it does seem that consumers might be open to the idea of sharing their longevity risk rather than insuring it. Clearly, potential reductions in income and the prospect of running out of money are the worst possible cases for consumer based on the theory. This is interesting in the context of the South African environment, where living annuities far outsell other retirement products. Consumer behavior is also very significant and cannot be ignored. There is a huge body of research and literature on consumer behavior, but very little is still known, and effective ways to influence behavior still seem very hard to come by. Having a government safety net appears to be extremely important. Anything is better than nothing in theory. When considering retirement planning, consumers should consider potential government transfers even when they are at very low levels. As with all research, even though we thought this was a brilliant paper, there were limitations to this. Simplifying assumptions that need to be made to make the paper or to make the modeling easier to work with are obviously unrealistic and tend to be inflexible. So they limit how dynamic the model can be with respect to modeling real life. Theoretical utility models are also just that, they are theoretical. Utility models that are parameterized in a qualitative way, so for example, using surveys or interviews, could offer much more value, but can be extremely difficult to populate. The authors did overcome this to some extent by allowing for some behavioral factors, such as the subjective mortality beliefs and the bequest motives. The utility and the mortality models were parameterized with inconsistent data. So the South African data was used to parameterize the mortality model, but the authors relied on other parameters from other data in other countries to parameterize the utility model. Unfortunately, parameterizing the utility model would have just taken too long, or with South African data, would have taken too long and was certainly outside of the scope of an honors research project. So what is wonderful about this research and what limitations we pick up is that always introduces opportunities for further research. At the most obvious level, parameterizing the utility model in a South African context would be important. Even if we were just to test the outcomes of the product by varying the utility model parameters within a range, that could give us some insight into how important it is to get that parameterization right. The mortality and wealth data that was applied could be considered to be out of date. This again could be an area for further testing. Also, the method that was used in order to determine the level of wealth or the initial level of wealth that consumers came into the product with was quite a crude method. So for me, the next step would be to refine that methodology and then potentially update the data if possible. A more complicated approach to the research would be to allow for the stochastic return modeling. This is obviously the gold standard. You would always want to allow stochastic return modeling. However, it is an extremely complex thing to do because there's lots of moving parts that then complicate other parts of the modeling. The pool of the annuitants were assumed to be perfectly homogenous. Some work has been done in these products to see in in-fund annuity pools and tontines how heterogeneity can be allowed for. Those structures could then also be run through utility models to compare the results against this study. Given the important outcome at higher levels of consumption, given the important outcome that higher levels of consumption do seem to trump the bequest motives of an individual, consolidation of wealth for an individual living annuitant would be interesting for me. So I've supervised other research on living annuities and their capacity to really be a disaster at the end. However, the caveat in that research is always that policyholders could have another source of wealth or income. So this is something that I really believe we need to get a handle on in the industry to try and consolidate that income or that wealth across individuals, especially where there's these really low initial investments in living annuities, and we don't know what other wealth or what other income these people have for retirement. Thank you very much for listening to me today. I hope that you enjoyed the presentation, and I'm open to any questions you might have.
Thank you very much for that. I think the conclusion that neither living annuities or guaranteed annuities maximize utility doesn't leave much choice if further research is important and should be done to actually maximize utility and provide maximum value to members. But let's take questions from the floor. We have a few minutes. There's a roving mic there at the back. Any questions from the floor? We have some questions online. Everyone's still getting warmed up, even there at the back. Let's start with our online questions then. The first one is, why would the pooled annuity payments reduce after age 80 if the mortality is as expected? If better, the pricing should be wrong or is wrong.
Hey, thank you for that question. The pooled annuity fund, what happens is if you outlive your peers, so age 80 might not necessarily be the average age based on the mortality that was used. The longer you live in a pooled fund, the if you experience the longevity and they've planned for a certain level of longevity. So if the overall longevity is higher than expected, then it doesn't really matter what the age is. You will experience reductions in your payments as a result of just too many people still being alive and the pricing being incorrect. That would be 100% what it is.
Great, thanks. And then another anonymous question. The tontine seems to strike as an opposite of what is a stock fell. How was the risk associated with the tontine moral hazard dealt with? Does the benefit outweigh the risk in the case where it is implemented?
Okay, thank you. That's quite a difficult question to answer because I don't think that typical tontine structures have really been implemented in practice. However, just that moral hazard risk, that is why they were outlawed in many countries or probably all over the world. But essentially, with enough regulation and the tontine structure and the way the research shows it more recently is that they tend towards a pooled annuity fund. So they tend towards some type of pricing involved with the mortality and not that if somebody dies, you get all their money. So it will. That's why I'm saying the tontine in the form that it is not applicable for a retirement product. It simply wouldn't work. It doesn't make sense. But if you apply some adaptations and there's a lot of literature around it, then there could be something out there that could be a good compromise.
Okay, so all the product developers in the room, some work for us to do. Any questions from the floor? Arthur, yes, there's the mic.
I was just going to say, is Arthur not there today?
Now, hi, Lucia. Nice to see you again. I hope you're enjoying life in Australia. All the best. Just a quick question, just a comment, Ops, really. One of the factors holding up annuitizing in South Africa has been the cost of inflation-linked bonds. They were extremely expensive, but now they've become a lot cheaper. So we are seeing more people annuitizing now relative to what happened in the past. So that is something to bear in mind.
Thanks, Arthur. So that's really positive for me. Obviously, the yields in South Africa are amazing. So I always tell everybody here that. That is really positive for me. And it would be interesting for me to see if there's been a change in the sales pitch. So if there's been a change in the way the products are being sold or if living annuities are still being pushed forward as the optimal product, but people are choosing to have a more secure guaranteed income that increases with inflation.
Great. Anyone else before we move on? Not. Okay. Thank you very much, Lucia, and for agreeing to present to us. It was great to have you with us here, although online. So hopefully we'll see you in person again at one of the seminars or conferences for a presentation. But thank you.
Thank you very much for having me and enjoy the rest of the day.